Hello and welcome to the Who's He podcast with me, Phil.
And me, Paul.
And on this episode, we're going to be talking about the case of Androzani, and of course we'll be comparing the TV version to the Target novelisation. So that'll be coming up a little bit later. But first, some news. Now, Scott and I mentioned this on the last episode about Doctor Who returning to our screens on the 11th of May with a double episode drop. Now, of course, the big thing is it's going to be on iPlayer from midnight and be shown on terrestrial television later on in the day, right before the Eurovision Song Contest, which is the grand final. I call it the grand final. Apparently, there are semi-finals, aren't there, or something, which I didn't know about, to be honest. But
I think there has been for a while. I think just because there's so many countries now that take part, if they didn't whittle them down before the final, it would be
an all-day contest, basically, wouldn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, and that would be my idea of living hell.
Is this the first time Doctor Who hasn't made way for the Eurovision?
Yes, that's right. Usually they sort of cancel it, don't they?
We have like a break, week. And it'll be Doctor Who will be back in 2 weeks' time.
Yes, indeed. But not this time. But I think they're making up for lost ground there, because obviously it's a double episode drop as well. But now, I said on the last podcast that I'm very much in the camp of I like watching Doctor Who and terrestrial television, and I should be waiting until later in the day to watch it. However, that opinion has changed slightly during the week, because obviously it being on early in the evening, or sort of at midnight on iPlayer, so you could watch it any time during that, you know, after then, is really a podcaster's gift, to be honest, isn't it?
Yes.
Yes. So, but what's your take on it, Paul?
I don't know. Yeah, I quite like the fact that when it was just you'd all settle down at whatever time, 6:30 or whatever on a Saturday, and you'd all see it at the same time.
Yeah,
and it meant you didn't have to remember not to look social media when you first get up in the morning.
Yeah, there is that thing, isn't there? Yeah,
which is the thing. I now feel I'm sort of almost forced. I'm almost going to be forced to watch it as the first thing I do when I get up, whether I want to or not. Otherwise, I've not got to watch social media at all for that day. And being a Saturday,
I know
it's probably on as well. It's yeah, a bit difficult. So.
Yeah, exactly.
I feel I'm being forced to watch it. I mean, I know you can block and whatever, but it's just too much hassle.
Yeah.
To be honest.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, as I said, you know, it's kind of a podcaster's dream, this, really, because you don't have to, you know, it's usually that you watch it for an evening, and then there's that. So okay, when are we going to record? You have to. I mean, now it's. You know, we can do it whenever we like, really, can't we? So, you know, it's if we wanted to be, you know, one of the first podcasts to to get our review out there as soon as it's finished airing on terrestrial television, that option is there for us now. I don't think we'll be doing that, will we? But
no,
but we can certainly do it a lot quicker than we have been recently. And as I was discussing with Paul before we started podcasting, or we start recording rather, usually it's Paul that goes on a holiday when Doctor Who returns to the screens. This year it's my turn, because I'm going to be away. But the way my holiday dates work, I'm not going to miss Doctor Who. So, and we can probably still get episodes out, but we'll cross that bridge when we come to it. But at least, you know, my stance has sort of softened a little bit. The option's there, isn't it, now? And I'm assuming this is going to be how it's going to be broadcast to the public throughout its entire run, not just for the first two episodes. I haven't seen anything to the contrary of you.
Yeah, no, I think this is basically this is how it's going to be from now on.
Yeah, yeah, I think so as well. So, yeah, I mean, it's
it's just a sign of, in some ways, you know, it's a good sign that Doctor Who is so global now that you can't just say, oh, well, 6:30 is good for us for the UK, so that's when we're gonna put it out.
Yeah, yeah. I know. It's upset a few people saying, you know, the British should get it first, and I've seen some sort of tweets or messages even from non-UK people saying that's a bit of a bum deal for us. But well, does anyone complain when stuff sort of drops all at the same time? Disney Plus for Star Wars content or Marvel content? No,
yeah.
I don't know why everyone gets their knickers in a twist because it's Doctor Who. I know, you know, Doctor Who fans are very, very sort of defensive of this show and nothing must ever change, but it's the way of the world now, isn't it? Streaming is a thing, and I think it's been long overdue since, you know, the BBC have been playing, well, catch-up, really, on the catch-up service. So if you take them, my meaning there, but It was bound to happen, wasn't it?
I mean, fine. Where in the world you might actually be getting it Friday tea time some places in the world, mightn't even that.
Well, I know because it will. I think in America it will be on Friday when it drops on Disney Plus before it hits the UK on Saturday at midnight. So it's really sort of Friday into Saturday, really, isn't it, for us?
Yeah.
But you know, I'm not going to be staying up at midnight to watch Doctor Who. You know, I can wait till I watch it, you know, during the day, or I'll wait until the broadcast. Oh, no, I'm not doing that. There would have been one time I would have done that, but...
Well, there would have been one time when we'd have been saying, that's brilliant, we get back from the pub, switch on Doctor Who.
I know, exactly. But I don't get back from the pub on a Friday night now, it's just...
No, I mean, yeah.
I just don't go to the pub on a Friday night.
It sounds like drink just took over your life, didn't it? goes out Friday evening, comes back sometime or Tuesday or Wednesday.
Exactly, with a pickled liver. It's a very tasty snack, actually.
I mean, there is also the good thing of the fact that, yeah, it doesn't... but it's probably actually that it's right at the end of the football season. Had it not been right at the end of the football season, I might have been even more enthusiastic about it being that time that I could actually get up Saturday morning, watch it, then go to football and not have to worry about getting home to see it.
Yeah, exactly. I'm not against it at all. It's just that's the way it is. You just got to accept it. That, you know, that's how it is. I mean, you can, no matter of how many much moaning and whining goes on about it, it's there and that's it. So and I don't know if that was a deal that was made or not, or it's just the BBC decided this is how we're going to, you know, present Doctor Who now.
Yeah.
One or the other.
I mean,
it's done and that's it. So.
I mean, I'm lucky I don't work on a Saturday, so it's not that I'm going to have to get, you know, go through the day knowing everybody else has seen it.
Yeah, precisely. Sort of precisely.
The only downside to it is social media and the fact that I probably will feel I'm forced to watch it while having my breakfast.
Yeah, indeed.
On Saturday morning before
It's not a bad way to start the day, Paul, is it?
No.
No, exactly. No. So, oh well. So, moving on, the last sort of item of news, really, it's probably as a shock to absolutely nobody that, you know, after months of denying his involvement, Stephen Moffat is indeed returning to Doctor Who, and apparently his episode will be in the next or the upcoming series. People are saying it's episode 3. I don't know if it's going to be that episode or not. I think people are just guessing. I've no idea. That hasn't been confirmed, has it?
No. Not as far as I've seen, anyway.
No, me neither. And I think obviously this was reported in the Daily Mirror months ago, wasn't it? And they've had a very good hit rate, haven't they, the Daily Mirror, with this series?
Yeah.
People, you know, I mean, even sort of going back to like Jodie Whittaker leaving, David Tennant coming back, Stephen Moffat writing, you know, it's all, yeah, they've been right on the money with a lot of things, actually. But I wasn't surprised. Paul, were you surprised with this?
No, not really.
No, Nina. Are you looking forward to it, more to the point, what he's going to do now?
Yeah. To be honest, what I'm looking forward to, but this, it feels like we're going to get back to Doctor Who written by individual people with just a running theme, perhaps.
Maybe.
Whereas, maybe, rather than even with people writing episodes under the Chris Chibnall era, it was that person and Chris Chibnall. I suspect we might get a bit more of an individualistic feel to episodes again.
I hope so. I mean, I'm obviously interested to see what RTD does with his second wind, and I'm looking forward to what Moffat does as well. Was it 7 years ago when he last did his last story, which was Twice Upon a Time? Was that his last one? Was it 7 years ago? Or was it longer?
No, probably. I lose track of
time. Yeah, I do as well, actually. So it'd just be interesting to see what that break has done for him, really, because, you know, I think there is a... And it happened to RTD, and I think it did happen to him as well. There is a case of sort of like burnout, isn't there? They both did it for such a long time, and I think there is that case of burnout with ideas and writing and everything. But I hope...
But like you say, you don't think he'd have come back to do an episode unless... It was a story he particularly wanted to do.
Yeah, exactly. The only other sort of, and it is just a rumour at the moment that and I hope this isn't true, really, because of the short episode run this time. But I've read that this episode that Stephen Moffat has written is a Doctor Light episode.
Right.
So I can understand there being Doctor Light episodes when you've got making a 13 or 14 episode run, but they're only doing 8, and to get, and I, that's what I'm saying, it's just a rumour, then there's nothing, I haven't had this confirmed by anybody, I haven't seen any official source, but I think just to have a Doctor Light episode in an 8 episode run, I find a bit weird. Everyone's thinking they were doing series 14 and 15 back to back. They haven't, because there has been a break in between filming. So although
it depends on, I suppose, how quickly they was trying to get the season done and completed. I mean, they may still have had time constraints on how, when people were available.
Maybe.
You know, part of the deal is you're not signing him to be Shooter Gatwell to be exclusively Doctor Who for 3 years or whatever, are you? So
no, that's right. Yeah,
there may be a point that he signs up to do so many weeks a year, and if you need to get all your 8 episodes in that time, then you might have to fiddle about with it.
Yeah, I mean, I keep hearing or reading the same rumours that Shooter Gat was doing 2 series and he's done. That keeps cropping up. But I think, you know, unless I see it in the Daily Mirror, I won't believe it, actually. But
unless Stephen Moffat denies it.
Yeah. But as we all know, Stephen Moffat lies, doesn't he? Yeah. Oh, dear. But, yeah, I mean, there's just a lot of sort of rumours circling at the moment. And if it is a Doctor Light episode, well, you know, so be it. I just think it's a bit weird if you've got a... an 8 episode run, one of those episodes doesn't feature the Doctor much. Okay, but
but then some of them have been the most interesting.
To be fair, they have been. But they were done out of necessity rather than anything else, weren't they? Because they were filming multiple episodes just to give the actor a break, or whilst they were filming on a different block or something, on a different episode. But we shall see. We shall see. Whatever happens. We're just lucky we still got Doctor Who on the television, really. And, you know, we should just be thankful for that, I feel. You know? Yeah. So, yeah. Okay, everybody. So that was the news. So coming up next, we're going to be talking about the Caves of Androzani, which I can't believe it's taken us this long to get around to discussing after 13 years. But there we go. So there we are. So for another episode then, that was the news. Right, everybody, we're now going to talk about the Caves of Androzani, but before we do, let's listen to a little clip.
Stand there. Couldn't we have a chair? It's been rather a strenuous day.
You will stand there until I finish with you. And when you address me, you will call me Sir.
May I ask who you are, Sir?
I am General Chelak, commander of all federal forces on this planet.
Well done, Sir. I suppose you started in the ranks.
Under emergency regulations, anyone caught supplying arms to the android rebels faces summary execution.
But we weren't supplying arms. We were... Well, we just found them.
Sir?
Sir.
Right then, Paul. We've discussed and cogitated, and it's your turn to kick things off, isn't it?
It is.
It is. Okay, so... what do you think of Caves of Androzani?
Now, this is a question of what do I think of the Caves of Androzani and what do I think of the Target novelisation? And taking it that we start off on this being the Target novelisation to the story, I have to say I'm a little disappointed with the Target novelisation.
I know what you mean.
And the reason being, probably, because I know this story so well. Although I'm not asking that as to be ask me any question about it. No, because my memory's not that good. But no, so I was sort of hoping I was going to get just something from the book that would surprise me, and I didn't really. I think it is very much the Terence Dicks taking it from the broadcast version.
Yeah. Because I think there was a quick turnaround there, because this was, obviously this is broadcast in 1984, and I think the book was released the same year, like a few months later.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there was a very, very quick turnaround on this. And it is a bit of a sort of cookie-cutter novel, this one, isn't it?
Yeah. And because actually, one of the things was, there were stuff said about this story that was cut because they didn't have time or whatever. Main bit being the way Perry says glass is she's mimicking how the conversation with the doctor in the TARDIS before they land. So I was sort of wondering which was then cut, which then was then not filmed. Obviously they did the location stuff first, and then by the time they got to the studio stuff, they was cutting stuff from the
stuff
studio
out.
And that
was,
that was never done. And I sort of wondered whether, are we going to get those bits back into the story? And we didn't, unfortunately.
No, we didn't. I will say, though, once I started reading it, because usually what I do, I'll sort of watch an episode, and then I'll read the novel up until that point, then watch the next episode, then read the novel to the end. So I'll try and read the novel as if it were I was reading an episode at a time. So it should have been four chunks. I actually read the book in one evening. And I must be honest, because I mean, I love the Caves of Androzani. And while we both agree that the book was slightly disappointing, I couldn't actually put it down. I just got swept up in the story again and I read it in one evening. It's a very, very quick read, this one. But
I mean,
very enjoyable.
That's also the thing about it, though, isn't it? As to why it probably is quite a straightforward. It's because it's such a cracking story, and it does work really well.
Yeah.
So perhaps, I mean, the conscious decision may have been that actually you don't want to change the pacing of it or anything.
No, it reads as
see that
it's a very good action adventure story, isn't it? Really, more than anything else.
Yeah.
And I know it's sort of people remember the televised version for certain things happening, and directorial choices, but probably which we'll maybe come on to later. But but as reading it as a story, it's a really good action adventure story, and it just goes from there's no padding in there at all, is there? Now, we kind of expect that with Terence Dix, really, because maybe because it was the script was written by Robert Holmes, and we all know how much Terence Dix admired Robert Holmes as a writer.
I mean, that's the thing. I didn't really expect Terence Dix to start making up his own story during it.
No.
But probably because I knew there was bits that hadn't made it to being actually recorded, I thought, and because obviously how much Terence Dix admires him, I thought he may well have gone back and tried to, and actually we might have got a novelisation of the script rather than a novelisation of the TV episode, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, unfortunately, it was almost like it was, I say sort of maybe a bit too sort of, he reveres Robert Holmes a bit too much to change anything. Like that's how it sort of came across to me, which is fair enough. But it was missing those little embellishments that Terence Dix is quite famous for.
Yeah, and never got. Usually, you might get a little bit more background on characters.
Yeah,
but we didn't on any of them.
No, no, we didn't, unfortunately. But.
And there's some interesting characters in this.
Yeah, there is. There's a couple of. There's one sort of minor thing about this. I think it was the description of Sheriff Jack. Obviously, he's dressed from head to toe in leather, so he's like the sort of like the gimp of Androzani, really, isn't he? But in that, he's got both eyes looking out of the mask, and obviously in the TV version, one eye is almost like a. It's like a glass eye, really, isn't it? To a certain degree. So, but that was the only sort of little change he made.
You don't know. I mean, that actually may have been just because of it was easier to do the makeup that way, and to apply the makeup by completely putting a side of that face on without actually having to try and work out how you line up the eye and all that you could just actually close off his eye and for when the mask is removed. So I suspect that it may well have started with two eyes. That may well have been one of the things from the original script that was you could see through both eyes, and then basically by the time they got to actually the makeup people doing it, it was just decided easier to
do that him. Yeah. You could be onto something there, but and obviously, there's not much else to say about the novel, really, because it was basically what you saw on the screen to a certain degree. I'll keep knocking my microphones down. I must apologise here, listeners. So the story itself, I mean, I love this story. You can see why people hold it in such high regard. And it was a very good way to end sort of Peter Davison's tenure.
I mean, really, well, it's just the marriage of an excellent writer and an excellent director, wasn't it?
Yes, indeed.
Probably for one of the first times.
Well, yeah, exactly. Because I mean, did we see Case of Androzani at the BFI back in the 50th anniversary?
Yeah.
And Peter Davison and obviously Nicola Bryant and Graham Harper on stage, weren't they? And I think even Peter Davison said then, sort of like the way Graham Harper directed the story, just by being on the studio floor and getting really stuck into it, was like a breath of fresh air. And I think, didn't Peter Davison say at that event that if that had been the way all the time, he might have stayed longer?
Yeah.
Because it sort of invigorated everybody, didn't it?
If Graham Harper had arrived earlier.
Yeah.
Before he'd made the decision to leave, he may well have delayed it a year.
Yeah.
But it was just the fact that, obviously, it really was the last knockings of his time as the Doctor, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, exactly.
There's no way back from
such
that.
Such a shame. But, I mean, what a way to go out, though, on such a well-directed, sort of pacey yeah. story. I mean, obviously, yes, it has got shortcomings. The magma creature looks ridiculous.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, really especially does. Seeing now the ideal opportunity that it's set in caves that are just lit by luminous rocks or whatever, that they could have really lowered the lights on that.
Yeah.
And just had the odd flash of teeth and eyes, couldn't
they? I know, it just... I think that's probably one of the few directorial mistakes he made on this one, because yeah. you've got all the... whoever the magma creature was attacking, they were based in the shadows, and it was in the spotlight.
Yeah. And I suspect he may well have felt that because they'd spent a reasonable amount of money on the creature, on the special effects for the creature, that he had to show it.
Mm.
Whereas I suspect if this had cut, when you're doing your first one, you probably feel that you've got to give everybody their chance to shine, if you like.
Yes,
to
indeed.
A certain extent.
Indeed.
Whereas perhaps if this had happened a couple of stories down the line directing, he may well have stepped in and said, well, no, actually, I don't want that.
Maybe. It's just... I mean, we all know sort of like monsters like this have always been Doctor Who's sort of Achilles' heel, to coin a phrase. But
and particularly Davison did seem to get some brightly lit ones, didn't he?
Oh, he did, so. Didn't he? Yeah, we have to look at the Forest of the Deep for that one, yeah. do we? And again, yeah. that was guilty of the same thing. It was overly lit. All they do is turn down the lights, and it would have hidden yeah. all the shortcomings of the Murka, for argument's sake.
Yeah,
you know.
But like I say, I mean, especially seeing this was in caves, they didn't even have to artificially pretend that the lighting was bad. They didn't have to come up with an excuse for why.
No, precisely. But I mean, it was. I think that's about the only sort of downside to it, really. The other thing as well, I'm sort of struggling to understand their version of events. I watched this from the DVD because I wanted to watch all the extras as well. I wanted to watch the documentary, the making of. And when it comes to John Normanton as Morgus talking directly to the camera, they're saying it was almost like a happy accident.
Yeah.
But they sort of kept that going all the way through. Did it in that first episode, which I understand that was the thing that was done in a hurry before they switched all the lights off at 10 o'clock. And that's all yeah. I don't mind it, but they kept doing it. But I think it was good for that first one. But as it got to like the last episode, and he was talking to someone on the screen, then he was turning around to the camera and talking directly
a bit
to
like
us.
Harry Hill.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, it was like, yes, exactly like Harry Hill. I thought.
I actually quite like that. And when you read the book and you realise how much internal monologue is going on in his head.
Yeah.
You sort of think, well, how else do you do this? Without him actually having anyone to turn to.
I know. I think it works in the book, but it doesn't. For me, it doesn't work quite so well on the screen. It's different because it's never been done before.
But the internal monologue stuff is too integral to the story to just be able to shut off, I think.
I know, exactly.
So... It was an interesting way to do it.
I know, it is sort of like, it seems a bit that happy accident, but I'm sort of like thinking, well, was it really a happy accident and it was actually sort of planned that way? I don't know.
I think it might have been, but like I say, I'm not sure quite how else you do it. Or you just have him sitting, staring into space forward, and his voice... giving the internal thoughts sort of thing.
Because that wouldn't work either, would it?
Which would have actually been quite a boring way of doing it.
it just wouldn't have worked. It really wouldn't have done.
No. So unless you're going to invite someone for him to either call up after or to be talking to properly otherwise, it was a difficult way to do it. And actually, I mean, I quite like it now. More enjoyed it actually watching it. That was one of the bits actually I enjoyed now watching this, because I was watching that almost fresh because I was going through to the having gone through the point where yeah, it makes perfect sense in the book that you can you know what he's thinking.
Yeah, yeah, it does in the book. Whatever, yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And then to watch it and think, oh, that's actually I quite like the fact that they've done that. I think that's quite a clever way of carrying that in.
Yeah, I think you're right in the fact it's probably the only way they could have done it because he's with no one else. I mean, it's the point of, well, who does? I mean, as particularly enough, it's the last episode when he's talking to General Chelak, and he does it like at least twice in the same conversation. And I'm just thinking, what's Chelak thinking? Why does he keep turning away and talking to himself? Who's he talking to? You know, nobody dare question Morgus and his methods. He's a person to be feared, but
breaking the fourth wall, I think, is quite. I quite like that.
It's certainly different.
It
doesn't work 100% for me, I'm afraid. It never really did, actually.
No, but unless you're going to completely rewrite... I mean, it'd be interesting if we knew how Robert Holmes thought it would be shot when he wrote it.
Yeah.
Did he have any ideas on how that was going to be? Or was it just written and left to... Go on then, put that one out.
Yeah, maybe it was a case of that. Who knows, actually? Who knows? The one thing that I had kind of forgotten about this story is just how bloody bleak it is. There's no one to. Usually in these sort of the doctor and Perry, whoever it might be, he's travelling with. There's always someone they will side with, isn't there?
Yeah.
To help out, but in this there is nobody. Both sort of opposing camps.
Yeah, nobody survives.
Nobody, exactly. I mean, you could argue it's a typical Eric Saywood style story, isn't it? You could definitely tell this is under his stewardship as a script editor. But there is no, I mean, apart from the Doctor and Perry, there is nobody to really root for at all.
I suppose you could say that.
Go on, mate, go on.
Yeah, they're just variations of bad, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, everybody. I suppose you've got some sympathy for Sheriff Jack, perhaps, but he's just as bad as the rest of them.
Yeah, he's into murder and kidnapping.
Yeah, precisely. This story is always sort of like, you know, at least one person covets Perry's beauty, which is sort of like. Only because we've seen all the stories, it's sort of like, oh, bloody, here we go again kind of thing. But, you know, I suppose it was quite new at the time, wasn't it? But it's just watching it with hindsight, it's a bit, oh, bloody hell, poor Nicola Bryant, but being pored over by the villain of the piece again. I think this story is also one of the biggest examples of the Fifth Doctor being completely passive in the story, because he doesn't really do anything at all, does he?
The only time really he comes alive is when he escapes on the spaceship.
Yeah. Yeah, now I'm glad you've come to that bit, actually, because that was one of the sort of the things that was kind of missing from the book. Now, in the book, he says when the Doctor's sort of flying the spaceship... And he said he's sort of, it's almost just saying he's sort of like losing consciousness because of the effects of the Spectrox and everything. Yeah. Sorry, I just knocked the microphone down again. Obviously on the telly, it's done sort of like he's beginning to regenerate, especially as you see what happens when he does, where you've got the same effect starts to take place. Now, it's never explicitly said that's what happens. Everyone just sort of said that is. Do you subscribe to that theory? That he begins, he's just holding back a regeneration.
Yes.
Yeah, same here, I do.
Yeah, it's sheer willpower to save Perry, isn't it? If someone had been able to get a message to him that Perry was safe at that stage, I think he'd have regenerated.
Yeah, I think
that's
as well.
Sort of how I've always viewed it.
Yeah, and I think it's... that build-up to the end of that episode 3... when Stotts tries to get back in, you know, back in the on the flight deck again, and the Doctor says, "There's nothing, no one's going to stop me now," kind of thing. I think that's a great cliffhanger, and it actually gave sort of the Fifth Doctor sort of like a bit more anger and desperation to, which we never really had before. Because usually when we get a cliffhanger with the Doctor, it's just a close-up of the Doctor's face looking perplexed or shocked, or but this sort of actually ended with him angry.
Yeah.
Which is a real sort of, you know, it's just a shame we got all this in this last episode.
Yeah.
It really is.
Yeah. I mean, and it is probably the direction, isn't it? It's that he's probably been told, like, you know, you can be angry or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah, just sort of it's that Graham Harper keeping the pace up, is it, all the way through. Yeah. There's not a dull moment, to be honest, is there?
No.
No, really isn't. I mean, what do you think? Let's go through the cast. Actually, I think Peter Davison, you can tell he's a bit more energised in this story compared to some of the others he's done. So I think he's probably one of the best performances he ever gave, actually, as the Fifth Doctor. Nicola Bryant, I mean, she didn't have a lot to do apart from looking sick and being pulled at by Shara's Jek, but I suppose she did what was asked of her, I suppose you could say. That's quite disparaging, actually, but I can't really think of another way to describe it.
I think it was good when best scene when her and the Doctor are first taken into General Shellac.
Mm.
And they're doing the whole surfing.
Yeah.
And I think that was good, and I think they worked well there, and that's probably the longest sort of speech bit she had. Most of the rest of the time, she's unconscious or...
Yeah, exactly.
Whatever, isn't she?
It's also another example of that writing that Robert Holmes does, that's that little double act thing. It's sort of like the door between sort of like, you know, he gets a double act going, he gets the sparkling... I sound a bit cliche, but, you know, sparkling dialogue, darling. But, you know, but that's what he's good at, that's what he's known for. And he, I think he manages that within quite a short space of time with the Doctor and Perry. Just a shame it was all undone once the Sixth Doctor gets there. But we've already done that particular story, haven't we? So
yes,
the following year. I really like that, actually. Christopher Gable as Shara's Jek?
I think so. In the over the top.
Yes.
Villain, which is actually hard when you've actually only got your eyes and mouth to work with.
Well, it's almost like a Stephen Thorne kind of thing, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
Where it's that, how do you express yourself behind a mask? And you do it by shouting, really. Yes. That's it.
I think he gets the mixture of menace and desperation and longing.
Yeah.
From the character.
Yeah.
He is probably the most well-rounded character in this. And I think that is portrayed as that.
Yeah, it's what you say about longing.
Not to be deformed or whatever.
Yeah.
Injured from the mud, really.
Mm.
You just, you know, the whole, you know, I was once considered whatever.
Didn't he say I was considered comely, didn't he say?
Yes.
Yeah.
Which actually is in the book as well. I wonder whether there'd be any difference or whether that was just something that came out on the set or whether it was, but it was in the book.
Yeah.
But yeah, and the fact that of when Perry screams when she finally sees his face and he goes and runs and hides under the table.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's too much for him.
Yeah, exactly. He doesn't want anyone to see him like that. No, there's when you said longer, it's that at the end, when he collapses into the android Salatine's arms, he just says, "Hold me."
Yeah. Yeah.
And that was quite sort of telling, really, wasn't it? That's all he really probably wanted, to be honest.
Yeah.
At the end. It's a very sort of tragic character, really, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, he probably is, as you say, the only one that you'd have any sympathy for out of them all. But he's probably one of the worst in terms of how he's reacting to people.
Yeah. Yeah, precisely. So what about, we've already spoken about him, John Normington as Morgus. It's just that voice, really, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's got that very sort of... No. It's such a menacing voice.
Yeah.
And I do think he's really good. I mean some of the lines after the president falls down the lift shaft, and he said, I come with the exact thing. It's sort of like, well, you know, it could have been worse. What do you mean? Well, it could have been me. I thought that's a great line and really well delivered as well. I thought, to be honest, but it's such a horrible character. But again, it's everybody's playing each other off against, you know, each party is, they're all sort of like got double standards, or they're sort of like, they're mistrust.
They're paranoid.
Exactly.
I think this is one of the actual best bits about this story, is the fact that you see that it actually, lots of it, not really much of the conspiracies and that are actually happening in real life. It's just they've basically wound themselves, they've got so, each character's got so paranoid,
yeah,
that they're now willing to believe anything.
Exactly. Well, it's almost like, well, it's almost like looking at Twitter, Paul, isn't it?
Yeah.
It just, people make their own minds up and then put it out as fact, and it just rolls from there. There we go. So, yeah, it was. This is 1984's answer to Twitter, right there with their paranoia and lies. Oh, God. I do like Morgus. I like these. Actually, there's one thing that is explained in the book is his hairstyle. The way it's sort of pulled back into that sort of short ponytail, it's meant to be sort of like a symbol of almost like wealth and power.
Yeah.
Which I thought was a nice explanation.
And the fact that he's from one of the first families of colonised.
Yeah, so I do like that actually. It's weird actually. Sort of you've got him with these pulled back ponytail or Croydon facelift as we know it in the UK, and then you've got the president with that amazing bouffant hairdo, but then you've got Timin, who's got the most dullest haircut. Out of all of them. The men trump the women for hairstyles. It's particularly in the 1980s as well.
I was going to say, the Croydon facelift, is that what you get when the Spectrox is running out?
Yeah, the supplies are getting a bit low. Just pull the hair back a little bit tighter.
Yeah.
Oh, dear, oh, dear. Yeah, it's... The hairstyles were amazing for the president and Morgus in this, but I think the other good character is Maurice Reeves as Stotts. I think it's how he pronounces his name, Reeves, because he has an umlaut above his E. I thought he was, and again another one. Was he as paranoid or just sort of like he'll go where the money is, basically?
I think he'll just go where the money is.
Yeah, I think he's just a typical mercenary, isn't he? I do like the character as well. I really do, and I think he's double cross. Actually, no, maybe I don't know. He double crosses people. I mean, he kills off Krilper and the other remaining mercenary at the end.
To cut down on what he has to share.
Yeah.
Once they've decided they're not going to come with him, then. Then he might as well kill them.
Surplus of requirements, aren't they? And that's that, really. I think it's. I do think it's.
One of the things in the book.
Yeah, sorry, go on.
Getting back to, because while we've just talked about that and the president, is I think in the book you don't quite get the full explanation about having the lift engineer killed. And one of the reasons why he wants to do it is because he blackmailed him over the price.
Yes.
Effectively.
Yeah.
It's finally getting his revenge on him.
Yeah, exactly. Because that does make more sense. Really, the book makes more sense. Of the fact why was there an empty lift shaft to push the president down?
Yeah, because you almost feel like was that an accident? that he just took advantage of. But no, it's actually he had the
he engineered the
doors would open without the lift being there.
Yeah. So, which makes more sense when he's going to have the lift engineer killed. It makes more sense of that in the book.
At that point, you're just thinking, oh, he's making the lift engineer a scapegoat. But no, actually, he's clearing up a loose end in case. Once someone finds out the president's been killed falling through an open door lift shaft.
Yeah. So, there's come up to that line, though, sort of like, well, it could have been me. Sort of like, I love it.
My other favourite line in this is the fact that the doctor saying about Sir Jack having an inflated ego. He thinks he's almost as intelligent as I.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, that is a good
almost my equal in intelligence.
the bloody cheek and temerity of the man. Crikey.
Oh, man. Yes. Yeah. Obviously, he's got an ego running wild.
So we've got Roy Holder as Crilper. He's sort of like the anti-Stotts, really, isn't he? As soon as the going gets tough, he wants out, doesn't he? And he's sort of like the mouthpiece of the rest of the troop, isn't he? Sort of like, you know, me and the boys, you know, said we've had enough, we want to go home, and easily sort of like pushed back into place again by Stotts. But he didn't have an awful lot to do in this role. I thought he had a bigger part in this, actually, Roy Holder. So when I watched it again, it wasn't that big a part, to be honest. He was quite silent in it most of the scenes, but it's still a good character anyway. So you got Robert Glenister as Saladin. What I thought was good in his dual role, actually.
I think he does well, because when you're watching it back now, you do actually sort of feel that it's a bit a very emotionless performance.
Yeah.
As the robot.
Yeah.
As the android.
Yeah, I think it's really well.
Which he then doesn't do as the real Saladin.
As the real Saladin. So quite. Yeah.
And you can see, you know, that he does actually divide that up, which is really clever.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I think the other thing as well about with sort of the human Saladin, I'd forgotten in the manner in which he was killed off, and that's with those sort of belt plate things to sort of like hide the fact they're humans from the androids.
The you've nothing to fear.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
they can't harm you.
That was almost comedic, actually, that part, but Yeah, I'd forgotten. I'd completely forgotten that bit entirely, to be honest. I was a bit, oh, crikey, that's how they got rid of the human version. But I agree with you. I thought he was very, very good as the android. And it's only really apparent once you see the human version, because you just accepted that's how he is. But then you see the human one, and it's like, oh, okay. So you begin to pick up on the little things he's doing as an android.
Yeah,
so I really liked it. So Martin Cochran as Chellak. I suppose you could say he's the only one who's sort of really straight down the line. He's a soldier, isn't he?
Yeah.
And he's not really... He's not paranoid to a degree. I think he just feels a bit foolish, doesn't he? When he finds out that the Saladin he's been trusting is a robot.
He's worried about saving face all the way through, isn't it? I mean, they kill the ensign, who's the only one who knows that they've shot androids with a firing squad.
Yeah.
He's very careful of his position and whatever. But you feel actually there is a reason. I mean, cause he even says about the doctor, doesn't he? About, you know, I sort of believe you, but that's how it is, unfortunately.
Yeah. Yeah,
some innocents die in war, sort of thing.
Yeah, precisely. Yeah, I think actually you come back to the firing squad thing. It's another Graham Harper thing. He does love his firearms, doesn't he? He loves a few machine guns sort of going off.
Well, wasn't there something in this that he was the one insisted that they was machine guns rather than laser weapons?
Yeah, I can't remember the reason for that now.
I think he just felt that it was easier to... it didn't rely so much on special effects in terms of to produce a death, so to speak, or, you know, to do the firing.
Mm.
Because it was obvious to people knew what an automatic pistol was and whatever,
yeah.
So, or machine gun was. So you didn't have to rely on the special effects being good to carry it off.
Yeah, I think that's a really good decision, actually.
Yeah.
They sort of tarted the I think the little, they're called Ingrams, those little machine pistols. I think they just tightened up with a few little silver canisters on them or whatever. But I think it works really well, and I like the fact that they've done that. And yeah, I think it just seems to add something. It adds the extra little bit of excitement to it, especially the end of episode one, where they're you know, when the Doctor, the robot androids, or Doctor and Perry are shot, and
yeah.
It ends just on the firing squad, doesn't it? It's all you see is the guns going off, and it's a wonderful way to end that episode. And it sort of, and it does stay in your mind, doesn't it? As well, it's the noise,
yeah,
going off,
yeah.
And I mean, also, I mean, especially what's happened on that set of the Alec Baldwin film, you know, with the person in charge of firearms making sure that there's, you know, all the guns are clear, they've got blanks, there's nothing, you know, stuck down the barrels and stuff like that, you know, sort of debris and whatever. It's at the end where the robot Saladin shoots Stotts in the back. I don't know if you noticed on that, but you can see the air from the muzzle flash. It sort of blows Maurice Reeves' hair. You can momentarily see it, and it also sort of, like, you can see it was like the wind on his jacket as well. You momentarily just see it, sort of like when he starts throwing the gun, you can see that the force blows his hair and his jacket slightly. I just begin to wonder whether they'd actually be able to do that now. Because he was really close with that. Well, okay, it's only firing blanks, but you know, there is that element of doubt there that something could go wrong. But yeah, I was quite surprised when I watched that. I thought, bloody hell, he's really close to him doing that. So it's, but again, it just adds something, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It adds that extra excitement.
Also, while we're at that point in the story, that's also the difference in the TV and the book, isn't it? That Jack actually strangles him completely.
Yeah.
Whereas in the TV, he sort of holds him between the...
Whatever that thing was.
Yeah, which was never ever explained.
No, exactly.
But
didn't appear to be switched on at any point. It just sort of happened, didn't it?
No, just happened.
Yeah.
Oh, the other bit I thought the book explained. Well, now I'm sounding like, oh, the book explained.
Oh, book explained. Yeah, the more we talk about it, there is a little bit of...
The whole thing about the turning on the air conditioning, which he turned off. To keep Perry cool, because the Doctor had said try and keep her temperature.
Yeah,
down,
yeah.
Which was the thing that they find, don't they? They hear the noise of, which leads them to his base.
Yes, that's right.
And it says, oh, he turned it off so the base couldn't be found by noise. But then he turns it on to actually help keep Perry's temperature down, which I think actually was quite a good thing in terms of explaining that, because that doesn't really happen, does it? It's just literally, oh, what's that sound? That must be his bass.
Yeah, exactly. It was a little bit sort of plucked out of the air, that bit. Maybe that's one of the things that Terence Dix did put in the book, just to try and explain that a little bit, a bit better, to make more sense of it, which it certainly does, actually. But
yeah.
So obviously we're all building up to the final part of the story, which is the regeneration, and sort of like the Doctor's sacrifice as well, actually, to save Perry.
The more I watch this and read this, the more I'm just thinking to myself, why didn't he just drink his bit of the bat
first
while he was by the bat, and then actually refill?
Yeah. Or just drink his half. If it only took half a little test tube to bring Perry back, he could have just drank his half, couldn't he?
Well, I suppose he might not have known. You could argue that he didn't know how much would be enough, and that he would have probably given Perry enough to see that she was recovering before he drunk what was left was probably his plan.
Yeah.
But yeah, but why he couldn't have just drunk his share while he was at the milking the bat, so to speak. Yeah. And then just refill take a full
take a full. I've just got this image now of the Fifth Doctor suckling at a bat's teat.
Yes. I was trying to avoid that.
It certainly is a powerful image, Paul.
It is. It is. But he didn't necessarily need to do that. He could have, drunk from the tube and then topped the tube back up again.
I know, exactly. Rather than sort of sucking on a bat's messy udder.
Especially on the basis that he had more chance of surviving once he'd taken.
Well, exactly. Because you're thinking he's...
So you'd have thought he'd do it just
to his strength
give himself
was...
a chance of...
Yeah, his strength was waning.
To make sure
wasn't
he actually
it?
Got back to
Perry.
To Perry.
Yeah. Yeah, precisely. But hey ho, you wouldn't have had that dramatic tension, and he probably wouldn't have regenerated.
I suppose that machine that suddenly comes alive and kills him and then blows up starts a fire that you don't get in the book.
No, you don't, do you?
Which means obviously why then the Doctor increases the Doctor's haste to get away rather than stopping to give Perry the milk there and then before making their getaway. Considering it had only taken 10 seconds to have poured the milk down.
Yeah, I know, exactly. But I do think though that this is I know now when we're used to the Doctor regenerating and a great big blast of special effects and the TARDIS blows up and everything and so on and so on. And I know back then they usually just sort of fade one actor in and one actor out and the next one in during a regeneration and they try something different with Tom Baker, with the Watcher. But I think even now, this is still my favourite regeneration.
Yeah.
I like the effect, I like the noise, the visual effects they use. And the way they describe it is sort of it's like the end of Day in the Life. It builds up to that crescendo. And I love it. I think it's the best one. And I know you've got all the previous companions, little floating heads spinning around and everything. But I love it. I think it's really good, and I think it holds up even today. Actually,
And even actually, I'm now going to say so. Oh, and the books. but even in that, I thought actually the book there said about the fact that obviously the companions are all there encouraging him to regenerate and whatever, and it says there actually it's the master willing him to die that probably has the greatest effect on his determination to carry on.
Yeah. So it was, I think in the TV version of the regeneration, it sort of builds up with that. That's what leads into that crescendo is the master's laugh, isn't it?
Yeah.
But which works really well. I mean, I was never sort of really that fond of Anciani's take on the master. It wasn't really his fault. I mean, that was more down to J&T wanting to play it like that. But his laugh in this plays into that regeneration, doesn't it? Really, really well. They sort of work it into the noise. Which is great. I think it's really great, actually. So I still love it.
It's an obvious time for the master to have a manic laugh.
Yes, well. That's right. So obviously then goodbye Peter Davison and hello Colin Baker and hello to the twin dilemma which followed it. I mean, it's just, I think there's maybe a place to sort of draw a line under this discussion really, because I mean, how can you go from Caves of Androzani to the twin dilemma in the space of a week, and you've got two completely opposing stories in content and style. I know when each Doctor comes on, there's always something a bit different about their stories and their tenure and the directors and writers and everything, but it went from the sublime to the absolutely ridiculous, really, didn't it?
Yeah.
It really did. as I said earlier, we have previously covered that story on the Who's He podcast. And we did cover the Target novelisation as well, which was written by Eric Saywood. It's probably one of the worst novels we've ever covered, actually, isn't it?
Yeah, the most memorable thing about that is the cat prologue, isn't it?
The cat, yeah, the cat's in a monologue, which...
which, obviously, if they'd have had that in the TV, they could have got Graham Harper to have done that. The cat could have been turning to the
like the Meow Mix advert from the 80s. Oh, Dave, if you don't know that, that's one for listeners of our generation there, isn't it? Oh dear. So anything else?
Actually talking about the thing, actually sort of one of the other things I remember about the when we went to the BFI for this.
Yeah.
Was Peter Davison talking about Peter Davison's probably his best performance as the Doctor and whatever.
Yeah.
Was he saying about his regeneration scene, isn't he? And saying how he thinks it was probably one of his best bits of acting of his career. He goes, and he only realised afterwards that no one's looking at his face.
No. Exactly. That's on the documentary, the making of as well. It's the phrase now. Graham Harper, obviously, this was recorded a few years ago. He's sort of like he didn't realise he was. That's what was in shot was Nicola Bryant's cleavage. But then he followed that with, "Oh well, it's something for the dads."
Which that's a 70s, 80s comment, isn't it?
It is, actually. Well, I was 14 when I watched that. It certainly wasn't something for the dads. It was something for a hormonal teenager. That's what it was for. So.
Yeah.
Oh, dear. So, anything else you want to say about this one, Paul, before we draw to a close?
No, I think that's it.
Same here.
I probably eked out more enjoyment from the book than I thought I had, actually.
Yeah, the more we discussed it, there was quite a few things there, actually, that sort of did help explain a few things that probably didn't come across quite so well on the telly. No, I really enjoyed that. I don't know why it's taken so long to get round to doing Case of Androzani. I really don't, but...
Because we probably felt it was one of those ones where we'd have actually difficulty doing a podcast because...
When it's so good...
something.
Yeah, we don't find a lot to talk about, do we? Yeah, that's what has happened on occasion.
No.
Yeah. But, no, we certainly blagged our way through that one, Paul, so...
Yeah.
Oh, dear. So that's that then. So we're not sure what we're doing next. I suppose it'll be a big finish one next, won't it?
Yes.
Actually, we'll try and figure out... what that's going to be, and I say, dear listener, you'll be the first to know, or second to know after us. And probably in between then, there might be another Who's Here at the Movies. I've got another film lined up to talk about, and I dare say Scott and I will be back in between as well. There we go. So we're sort of nearly there with the new series of Doctor Who, so we haven't got too long to sort of pad a few more weeks out, Paul. We're nearly there.
Yeah, we probably, if we do a big finish next month, then that probably then takes us into the next series,
yes, indeed. So we'll, can't wait, actually. Can't wait. Should be exciting times. So
nearly halfway through the year already.
I know. Bloody hell. And hopefully before May the 11th, Paul and I will figure out exactly when we're going to record our reviews, whether it's going to be on the Saturday or on the Sunday or... during the week as usual, but if we got the option to watch it whenever we like, so let's be thankful for that. So anyway, until then, it's goodbye from me, Phil,
and goodbye from me, Paul.
Goodbye. Thanks for listening. You can download this podcast from iTunes, Amazon Podcasts, Spotify, and through your podcatcher of choice. If you would care to leave us some feedback on iTunes, that would be very much appreciated. You can also find us on Twitter at @whose_he_podcast, on the Who's He Podcast Facebook group, and through our website, whose-he-podcast.co.uk.